It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about pensions. They've been in the news a lot lately, but what exactly are they? How do they differ from other retirement plans, and are they on the way out? We'll get an explainer coming up in about 10 minutes.
The first big winter storm of the season is hitting a good chunk of Wisconsin today. Freezing rain, sleet, fog, and significant snowfall are all on the table. But are you ready for it?
We'll get some advice in just a minute, but we also want to know, how do you prepare for winter weather? What tips can you share with us? And do you actually like this weather? If so, what do you do to enjoy it, or what do you do to cope with it? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
Joining us now is Todd Pritchard. He's the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for Wisconsin Emergency Management. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a quick update on what this storm is doing in Wisconsin so far?
Yeah, really, it's every part of the state's having some different form of winter right now, right? Northwestern Wisconsin is getting hit by heavy snow. We're kind of concerned about a band of potential freezing rain going through kind of west central into north central Wisconsin overnight into tomorrow. Then we have severe fog kind of in the lower, southern part of the state. And then behind all this stuff is a cold snap, the likes of which we have not seen for a long time. I mean, we're talking about potential wind chills in the, minus 25, minus 30 degree range when we get into next week. So we're really going to see just about everything here in the next 72 hours or so.
Yeah, I just saw a symbol on my iPhone for weather that I've never seen before in Bayfield right now. So I think it looked like it's hailing. It shows these little balls plinking around. So it looks like just about everything's going on.
Yeah, and that I think is really kind of the big concern over the next, especially 24 hours, probably, is that freezing rain. You've got slick roads that are either, they're already wet, that have had some moisture on them. They might freeze up overnight and into tomorrow as that cold system comes through and temperatures drop. And then the potential of having a kind of rain and freezing rain on top of that. We're watching for the possibility of having a quarter to a half inch of ice buildup. And of course, if we get that on trees and power lines, we could see a lot of folks losing power and trees going down and roads becoming pretty slick. So I think the best thing that folks can do for the next few days is really watch the road conditions, first of all. The Department of Transportation has their awesome 511 site, so you can go to www.511wi.gov and check out the road conditions. They update it continuously. Or you can just call 511 from any phone in Wisconsin, and they'll update you on the roads. And I think we really just need to kind of watch out for the potential of folks, losing power and having, that kind of thing happen.
We've had a lot of months to forget how to drive in winter weather. Any quick reminders for us from emergency management?
Yeah, you know what? It's so common sense, but you're right. We always forget, and it always takes those first few snowstorms to remind us all, just slow down. That is such a key. It sounds like common sense, and it is, but, taking it easy on the accelerator, taking it easy on the brake, making sure that you're not making any dramatic moves. And remember, your car is not going to stop on a dime like it usually does on a clear, sunny, warm summer day. It's going to take a lot longer for it to stop. That momentum is not working in your favor at this time of the year. And we really encourage folks to make sure they have a winter kit in their car, because if you're driving, especially in remote parts of the state, if you get into trouble, if you slide into a ditch, it may take a while for a rescue folks to get to you. And with these kind of bitterly cold conditions that we're facing, it really is potentially life-threatening if you're stuck out in the elements. So, having a kit with, just some basics, a flashlight, just some snack food to keep you going, a blanket, extra clothes. I always think it's a great idea to have a cell phone adapter in the car, because the moment you need to call for help is the moment you don't have any battery power left in your phone. So, having that to be able to plug in and just a little trick that, keep at least a half a tank of gas in your car. If you are stranded, at least you can run the engine every, hour. You could run it for just a few minutes to kind of warm up the car. It's not going to be toasty warm, but warm enough to keep you going. And And if you do that, you know, just crack the window just a little bit to let some fresh air in to make sure there's not a danger of carbon monoxide.
Quick reminder that we're talking about winter weather, and we want to hear your winter coping tips. So what do you do to prepare for rough weather? What do you do to enjoy the snow and cold or to avoid the snow and cold? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Todd, outside of the car, what are some of the ways we can make sure our homes are ready for winter storms and those possible power failures?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Having some basic supplies in your house just in case that you're kind of stuck there for a while is always a great idea. And remember, you know, when the power goes out, sometimes people think of alternative ways of getting heat into a house, especially if you have electric heat. But remember, never use like a gasoline or a propane heater or a grill, like a gas or a charcoal grill, inside a home or any kind of unventilated area. You know, carbon monoxide is such a fast killer, and that is one way we lose so many people every year across the country by folks using those kind of tools in ways that they're not meant to be used. So, you know, really be careful of that. And this is a great time if you haven't had a chance to, you know, get your furnace checked out, make sure it's in good working order. And, of course, you know, make sure you have a carbon monoxide detector on every level of your home. It's required by law, but even better, it's just peace of mind and just common sense to make sure, just like having a smoke detector, that carbon monoxide detector can tell you if that, you know, that gas that you can't see, you can't smell, you can't taste is in your home. We just had an incident on Saturday where 8 people in Janesville were treated for carbon monoxide poisoning in their home. So it happens every year, and it's so preventable.
Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Todd Pritchard. He's the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for Wisconsin Emergency Management. And now let's go to the phones. We have Cindy joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
What do you think about the weather?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
I'm one of the few.
You're one of the few. And what is it that you like about it?
Well, growing up, my dad would always tell us that, you know, he did winter camping, and when they worked for the CCC, it was a lot of hard work and, you know, didn't matter what the weather was. And the attitude they took was the weather was never bad. It was the clothing or how you were prepared. So I agree with the emergency management guy. Make sure you have stuff in your car, boots, snow pants, especially if you're traveling off, you know, main roads and stuff like that. So
be prepared.
Yeah, I love being outside. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Cindy.
We'll go now to Dan in Racine. Dan, hi.
Hello there.
Hi. What's your advice?
Well, I'm a delivery guy, and I drive a pretty good-sized truck. It's not as large as a semi, but just a friendly reminder that I definitely will not stop on a dime. And sometimes the traffic, people in the small little cars don't remember that.
And so they pull up right in front of you, or you've left some safe stopping distance between you and the car ahead of you, and they fill that up, huh?
Exactly. Happens every day.
All right. Well, Dan, you drive really carefully out there, and I hope the people around you will drive carefully as well.
All right. Thanks to Dan for that call. And let's move next to Janet in Platteville. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My thing that I used to carry a lot in the winter was a coal shovel. I think you can still buy them. It has a flat edge across it, a short handle. It's not like a garden spade, so it fits in the car fairly easy, and it has an edge on the sides of the actual shovel part, and so it goes right under the wheel. It fits right under it, that you can scoop out the snow or ice that's literally under the wheel.
Okay, so easier for digging out.
Yeah, and it fits in the car, like I said. It has a short handle with a D handle, and it just fits good in the garage.
All right, that's good advice, and I think I've got a coal shovel around, actually, from my grandfather. So thanks for that, Janet, and be careful out there. Thanks for your help. Well, thank you for your calls as we get ready for a winter wave coming through. A lot of messy stuff making its way through the state, fog and ice and hail and freezing rain. And after that, a cold snap.
Mm-hmm. Lots to look forward to and get ready for. Well, coming up, we're going to take a closer look at how pensions work and how they could be affected by recent news from Detroit and now Illinois. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Yesterday, the Illinois state government ended emotional debate and reached a compromise on pension reform. Also yesterday, a judge ruled the city of Detroit is eligible for bankruptcy.
This has a lot of people wondering, what would happen to pensions for city workers in Detroit? And what is the future of pensions? They seem to be on shaky ground in cities and municipalities all over the country.
Alicia Minnell joins us now. She's the director of the Center for Retirement Research and a professor of management sciences at Boston College's Carroll School of Management. Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, I want to start with the basics, so Pension 101. What is a pension?
A pension is a benefit that the employer provides that guarantees you will get a certain amount of money once you retire. And it's usually calculated by some accrual rate. For instance, you might earn 2% of per year of your final salary for each year of service. So if you were there for 30 years, you'd get 60% of your average salary in the last 5 years, let's say.
Now, how is that different than other typical retirement plans?
Well, I'm a private sector worker, and so I have a 401k plan, which is essentially a savings account. So I have some money taken out of my paycheck each month and put into essentially a savings account, and my employer matches. And what I have at retirement is however big that pile is and whatever I can buy get in terms of income from that pile.
And how are pensions?
I bear the risk, and whereas in the defined benefit plan, the employer bears the risk.
I see. And in terms of how pensions are funded, how are they funded?
So in theory, the employer would put aside enough each year so that when the amount grows by some assumed investment return, that the pile would be big enough for the employee to cover all that employee's benefits once they retire.
Now, you talked about being a private sector worker and having a different retirement plan. So is it that pensions are pretty much the domain of public workers?
At this point in time, yes, that's right. In the old days, before about the 1980s, defined benefit plans or pensions were also very common in the private sector, but they virtually disappeared over time.
Do we have a sense of how much pensions cost cities and municipalities, how big a load they are?
Yes. I mean, it's a very good question, because when you talk about pensions, you can talk about trillions and zillions of dollars. They're mind-numbing numbers. In terms of the burden of pension expense on states and localities, it's around 5% of their budgets. That doesn't really measure how much they should cost, because localities and states aren't putting in the full amount they should. And also, critics would say that they've understated the full amount. So, but it's not 50% of budgets or 25% of budgets. It's somewhere between 5 and 7 or something like that.
Looked at, you know, in the big picture, is that 5 to 7% significant when you're trying to balance some budget?
Yeah, I mean, because people don't have a lot of localities don't have a lot of discretionary money, so it's definitely significant. It of course varies across the nation, depending on the generosity of the plan and how well funded it is. But it's definitely significant. I just use that figure because it sort of puts in some context the dialogue about pensions.
It seems as though right now, when cities and municipalities are struggling, you know, you look at Illinois, the state of Illinois, you look at the city of Detroit, that one of the first places they look is the pensions. Why is that? Why are they being targeted as a place to cut back right now?
So I think Illinois and Detroit are sort of different. In Illinois, and also I'm very concerned because all this focus on Detroit and Illinois is sort of being interpreted as if that's representative of what's going on in the whole rest of the country. I mean, Illinois is the worst state in terms of just being physically irresponsible in terms of funding its pension plan. It made agreements with workers that they were going to get money when they retired. The workers put in their share of the contributions, and the state just did not. And so they have one of the, you know, some of the worst funded plans in the country. In terms of Detroit, Detroit just has a whole host of problems, and you know, which have led to an exodus from the city and declining revenue base and sort of a spiraling down. Pensions there are actually there are some scandalous stories, but they're actually well funded because the city took out a pension obligation bond and put that money in the pension fund, and so pensions are certainly one of the items on the list of commitments that could be reduced as Detroit goes through the bankruptcy process.
Now, you're saying people are getting worked up over Illinois and Detroit, and in fact, it's these are special cases, but this is something that people are saying, that this could be, you know, the sort of canary in a coal mine for pensions. These are cities who are troubled and states that are troubled financially, but you know, pensions, they seem to be pretty vulnerable right now. Don't you think that there might be something to that concern?
So, yes, of course. I mean, they were actually very vulnerable in the wake of the immediately after the financial crisis because their funding numbers dropped precariously. Then they've sort of been, and there was also a demonizing of public sector employees at that time. And that seemed to me that had all sort of quieted down a bit. And now you've got this Detroit and Illinois events, which seems to have reinvigorated the sort of call that something has to be done about pensions nationwide.
Now, why has the pension format gone out of style? Why has it become the model you just talked about, the 401k?
So in the private sector, well, basically the pension puts all the burden on the employer. The employer promises an amount, and for life. And so, if people live longer than expected, it becomes very expensive. If employers can't earn the return that they sort of use for calculating their contribution, then there's sort of a shortfall that they have to make up. And in the private sector, it just accounting rules changed, and any shortfall showed up on balance sheets, and people and sponsors were required to make up these shortfalls quickly, often when times were tough, and businesses just did not want any part of it. And so 401ks appeared on the scene in the early 80s, and basically every new company that started had a 401k, and the companies that traditionally had defined benefit plans went out of business, and gradually over time, one has replaced the other. After 2000, actually in the private sector, you saw people actually shutting down their defined benefit plan or freezing it and putting in a new 401k.
Let's take a call here. Margaret joins us next in Oshkosh. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Great show. My question was, well, my understanding was that in the 80s, the 401ks kind of came along as a way for companies to have their employees invest back into the company. And then when the company did well, you then did well on your investments. Well, for private sector, that works for a private sector, but for public sector workers, they're not for profit. So that's why my understanding was that that's why the pensions for the public sector remained. Now, many, and also my other understanding is, if you can elaborate on any of these, that the public sector employees, many of them have a portion that they put into their pension, and then the employer, the state or federal, local employee also puts in a portion. But it's not all funded by the employer, the taxpayers. So if you could elaborate on that, and I'll take my question off the air.
All right. Thank you, Margaret. Alicia?
Margaret, those are a lot of good questions. The 401k, interestingly, is put in as sort of a supplementary way for private sector workers to save. They already had these pensions, and they had Social Security, and so this was sort of an add-on. You're right. In a lot of cases, they did invest in company stock. But I don't think that the lack of company stock in the public sector is the reason that the pension has survived. I think, one, you don't have this churning. You know, in the private sector, you have businesses coming into business and then going out of business, and so you have a way of sort of moving from one type of pension coverage to the other. Also, people in the public sector really tend to be, there's some evidence that they're more cautious. They really want a defined benefit, something that they can count on and when they retire. And you're absolutely right. In the private sector, the plans were non-contributory. They were all paid for by the employer. In the public sector, they're financed jointly by the employee and the employer.
We're talking to Alicia Minnell, director of the Center for Retirement Research and a professor of management sciences at Boston College's Carroll School of Management.
And we want to hear from you, your questions about pensions. Maybe you have a pension. Are you worried about it? What do you think about pension systems versus 401ks or 403bs? Do you have a preference? Are you an employer? Which way would you like to see things go? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Alicia Minnell, director of the Center for Retirement Research and a professor of management sciences at Boston College's Carroll School of Management, talking about the future of pensions.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a pension? Are you worried about its future? What do you think about pension systems or 401ks and the other retirement systems out there? Good idea? Outdated? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
We've been taking a look at two states which are doing different things with their pension systems. Yesterday, Illinois passed a compromise bill that would trim retiree benefits and have people increase state contributions. And we have Detroit going bankrupt and looking at what that could mean for those holding pensions in that state. And we're going to go next to the phones and see what you have to say about this. We've got Tom on the line from Portage. Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Doing okay. How are you?
Good, thanks.
What do you think?
My thought is this. So often it talks about pensions. You hear talk like someone, one of your speakers said a little while ago, some pensions are totally funded by the employers, he or she said, versus some that are funded partially by the employer and employee. My thought is, it's all when someone goes to a job, you're offered a salary plus perhaps a pension. It's part of your compensation. So it all comes from the employer, my wages and my pension, for example. So it's part of that person's compensation. To say that it all comes from the employer, then you're implying that someone's a freeloader. And I keep hearing that nationally, locally, everywhere in this debate about pensions. And it seems like the media loses sight that that's part of that person's compensation. It's part of what maybe they gave up on their wages to help fund their pension. I know a lot of the teachers did that. They take less money on the check to get more money on the pension later on.
Right. Well, thanks for pointing that out, Tom. Appreciate your call. And, you know, looking at Detroit, they have some laws protecting pensions there on the books, I believe, and advocates of keeping those pensions saying, you know, we've already paid in, so how can you cut it back now? What about those concerns, Alicia?
Well, I think Tom's point is really important, and I'm embarrassed as an economist that I didn't make it, in that the employers do decide how much total compensation they want to provide to an employee, and then they divide that between how much they want to pay in cash wages and how much they want to pay in fringe benefits. So in essence, the employee actually does pay for the whole pension, no matter who makes the contribution. And, I mean, that's what's lost in some of the cuts that we've seen in the wake of the financial crisis, is that for new employees, particularly, who have no seat at the table, they've dramatically cut pension benefits and yet have given no thought to raising wages. And so what you're going to see, that new employees are just going to have much less total compensation than they would get in the private sector, and you get what you pay for. You will get lower quality public employees if you offer them a smaller package.
Thank you for the call, Tom. And we go next to Courtney in Madison. Hi, Courtney.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my phone call. I personally love pensions. I am a public employee, and like Thomas said, I contribute to it. With that being said, I just want to say we all work very hard for our money. And one thing that I like about the pension and that the guest is saying is that not so much, well, it's guaranteed. What I find very disheartening, and I was educated with a frontline, it was called a retirement gamble. What I understand from that is mutual funds and 401ks within the mutual funds came into play in the 80s, and yes, it saved companies money, and of course, then the mutual funds and the mutual fund headers then made a lot of money off of that. What the gentleman in the retirement gamble piece made the comment was, and it was very big, is that we then, in our retirement, we're putting up 100% of the risk. And what I think is so very sad, and we saw it in 2008, and like I said, we work very hard for our money, and we want to retire at a reasonable age. And then if we do that in a 401k and in these mutual funds, we're putting up our hard-earned retirement money and risking it for these mutual funds, these people that are then, you know, the mutual headers, so to say. Sorry, I'm not being articulate. So if that makes sense, I think pensions are great. I wish everybody could have them.
All right. Thank you for the call, Courtney. And Courtney making the case that the pensions have a stability that investing in a 401k may not have, you know, which can vary with the market. What do you think, Alicia?
Well, she's absolutely right. Just a couple of comments. One, I think it would be very hard to argue the 401k system has been a success. We know how much money that households approaching retirement have in those, including their individual retirement accounts, because sometimes they roll over money. And so $120,000 is what the typical household has. And that is just not going to take you very far in retirement. So, and if things go wrong, the employee bears all the risk. I think what's becoming clear is that when you have these pensions, they are very pleasant for the employee because the employee doesn't bear the risk, but all the burden is on the employer. When you have the 401ks, the employee bears all the risk. And probably what we need is some kind of shared risk system that you aspire to give the employee some pension. But if things don't turn out, if you don't get the investment returns, or if people live a lot longer, then somehow both the employee and employer are going to have to share that shortfall, because all on one or all on the other doesn't seem to be working.
Is there a hybrid like that out there now?
Yeah, so it's certainly there are hybrids like that in the Netherlands. There are some being tried in Canada. There are some states where the cost of living adjustment depends on the rate of return. So, yes, I think that there are certainly models that could be adopted. But instead of saying we have to have pensions or 401ks, I really do think we need something in between.
Let's take another phone call. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Hey, Nick.
Hi. I'll never be able to retire, ever. I mean, I've pretty much put retiring aside. The sad thing is my company's huge. We're in like 30, 40 states, and we're in 3 or 4 different countries. And, I mean, the contract we have that I'm working for is $5 million. Las Vegas is $57 million they're making, and we don't have any retirement fund. I mean, it's nobody really cares about the people that, you know, don't have it. So it's kind of a shame, but I plan on working out until I pass away.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Nick. And Nick, I think, is expressing a sentiment and a belief that a lot of people have, that they're either going to have to work much later or that they won't be able to retire at all. And, you know, I wonder if you could just comment a bit about what you see as the future of retirement in America, as some of these, you know, things that we've sort of taken for granted, retirement at 65 or what have you, might be a thing of the past.
So Nick actually brought up two important points. This one issue of working later. I think we are going to have to work later. I mean, we are living a lot longer. We're healthier. Our jobs are less physically demanding. It's just very expensive to work for 40 years and try to support yourself for 20 years and save enough so that you can support yourself for 20 years. So I think working longer is part of our future. And it's something we should probably embrace and find a way to do. Not everybody can do it. Some people have health issues. Some people don't have the right job skills. But for the vast majority of people, they can. The other point that he brought up, though, is that, you know, if you take a snapshot in the private sector at any moment in time, less than 50% of people are working for an employer who provides anything, either a pension or a 401k. So that means two things. One, that some people just never pick up any coverage over their whole lifetime. Some people move in and out of coverage. But it means that a lot of people are going to have very low 401k balances if they have any. And then a lot of people are going to rely just on Social Security. So the coverage issue is a really big one.
And Alicia, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Veronica, my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Alicia Minnell, Director of the Center for Retirement Research and a Professor of Management Sciences at Boston College's Carroll School of Management.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a guest who says social media has some positive benefits for young writers, despite the bad rap it gets. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Music is a cornerstone of Jewish culture, especially during holidays and festivals.
Milwaukee musician Lil Rev grew up in a musical family. He was steeped in his family's Yiddish folk music tradition. He travels the country, sharing his love of music, history, and his Yiddish heritage in today's Wisconsin life.
Well, I started playing guitar at about the age of 12. Paid for a couple of lessons, and then from there went about learning from anyone I could and listening to records and trying to figure out songs like so many of us often do. My grandfather played mouth organ, and my mom sang a lot of Broadway songs, and my grandparents did a lot of old Yiddish folk music, so I did grow up around a lot of music. My dad was a huge music fan. I always was bringing home records. I remember dancing around the house, everything from the Kingston Trio to Harry Belafonte to Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, and all kind of music that my dad was listening to at the time I was subjected to. But, I knew that I wasn't destined to be Ozzy Osbourne. And I had grown up with all this great folk music, like the Yiddish stuff. But, you know, when you grow up, that's just something that grandpa does. And it's not necessarily hip or cool. But as you get a little bit older, you see, I don't have to go really looking too far for a sense of authenticity because I grew up around it. You know, my grandparents, that was about as authentic as it got. Singing songs of the old country, you know, Tumba Laika and Oifen Pripichik and some of the classic Yiddish stuff. And, you know, if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, you know that our people are people of tradition. And I became really interested in the history of the music as much as performing it. I think to this day I enjoy the stories and the history of the music almost as much as I do interpreting a lot of it and writing my own songs as well. As I became a musician, my heroes oftentimes were my next-door neighbors. There's a guy in Milwaukee named Paul Melrude who I regularly still get together with. He's in his early 90s, and his door is always open for me to come and work on old Yiddish songs with him and pronunciations and things like that. So it's that human connection that I'm drawn to more so than anything. And when I can sing a song that I actually learned from someone like that, it means a whole lot more than any tune I will have ever learned off of an old long playing record, you know, because it's the real deal. I guess if you don't know where you came from, you know, you'll never get where you're going or something along those lines, right? I feel like one foot should always be rooted in that tradition. My grandfather, he had all these little wise sayings, and of course, most of them had Yiddish, connotations about work and work ethic and stuff like that. He'd say things like, "We've all been riding on the coattails of those who've gone down before." So I guess it's always been important to me to acknowledge the road that was blazed by those who came before and the gratitude that we should all have for those who opened doors for us.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Coming up on Central Time, a new report shows that young people don't want to run for elected office. We'll talk to the author of the report and get your thoughts, too.
First, social media often gets a bad rap when it comes to writing skills for students. Our next guest says there's some good reasons for that, but he sees positive benefits where social media can make kids into better writers. Andrew Simmons is a writer and teacher in California. He has a new piece on students and social media in The Atlantic.
Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hello, good to be here.
So a lot of people give Facebook a bad rap and other social media when it comes to writing. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, there are obvious reasons why you would give social networking a bad rap in the education writing world. I mean, writing used to be kind of a social necessity. You know, people of my parents' generation, I was born in 1980, and people of my parents' generation, they grew up writing letters, and so they transferred that same letter-writing talent, that ability that they honed in their youth to writing emails. My generation, you know, we write emails. We grew up writing emails sort of towards the end of high school. I think that became kind of comfortable for me. But we still wrote emails as if we were writing letters. And now, you know, attention spans have withered and people are communicating in shorter bursts of language, and conventions have kind of eroded chronically over the years. You know, I remember writing in all lowercase and thinking that that was a little daring to that capitalization stuff. So, you know, as people are writing less and less outside of the academic world, I think you can make a really good argument that, you know, students are maybe a little less comfortable writing in an academic way. You know, the conventions that some of us just kind of grew up, some of us grew up knowing might be less accessible to these teenagers today, and they need to be kind of retaught them a little more rigorously than maybe previous generations. But, you know, I mean, it's still communication. It's still written communication. And, you know, in my article, I think that I sort of lay out my belief that I don't think that Facebook and Twitter and social networking sites of that sort have made students better at the craft of writing at all. I think it's probably taken away from that significantly. But I do think that when it comes to personal narrative writing, I personally, as a teacher, my own observations, again, this isn't a scientific study or anything, my own observations, I've seen especially young men more willing to share thoughts.
Well, and let's get into that. You say that while it may be a stylistic minus, a negative, there's a lot of positive stuff, and especially in the realm of self-reflection and emotional expression. So how is the practice that these teenagers are getting online translating into their writing and how they write?
I think that just the space that's created by social networking where students, you know, kids have distance from one another. They're not looking each other in the face. They're not having to be brave and bold when they're sharing something personal about themselves. And that personal thing, you know, it can run the range from, you know, family abuse to insecurities about appearance. You know, it's a broad, I'm defining the category very broadly. But I think that being able to sort of have that illusion of anonymity, which can be a bad thing. It's bad to feel as if, you know, you can do whatever you want on the internet. Obviously, that's not true. But to feel as if, you know, I can admit something that I might not admit in person, and doing so will make me a little more comfortable with the idea that I have these thoughts. And then maybe when I'm in English class and I receive a personal narrative assignment, because I've taken that step of sort of giving myself that freedom, that right to, express myself in that limited way, now I can sort of elaborate on it. I'm more prepared to dig deep and reflect on whatever it is that is troubling me or concerning me.
And so, when you give those personal, when you give those personal narrative assignments, does that translate? Do you think that that the students are more willing to open up like they do, like they've practiced doing on social media?
Well, I only have my own experiences to really hold in context and those of the people I grew up with and went to school with. But I am seeing today's students, you know, today's popular athletes, today's, you know, cheerleader type students who are in my classes, these students are extremely forthright about insecurities in their writing. And that goes on down to the students that, you you know, 20 years ago, I imagine would have been more likely to be picked on, and perhaps still are picked on frequently at school. But the general pattern I'm seeing is that students are more likely are more comfortable talking about their deepest, darkest secrets in writing, which I think is a healthy thing to do. I think social networking has had a lot to do with that shift.
And if there was a stereotype of boys or of males, I guess, in our society, it's that we're not as willing to express ourselves emotionally. We're supposed to keep our insecurities concealed. Do you see a particular difference in just your personal observations with the boys who come through your classroom?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize. Mm-hmm. I know high school can be dangerous terrain for, any sort of kid. But, I think this traditionally masculine traits of stoicism and silence and kind of internalizing all your frustrations and insecurities and not wanting to reveal any of them because that's a sign of weakness and men can be weak. I think that stuff still exists to a certain extent. I think when students are able to do writing, that helps them kind of chip away at that, and they feel safer when they're writing about personal experiences and those thoughts in that way, that I think that they can start to formulate a little bit of a resistance to that antiquated mentality.
So in teaching writing, do you think there are ways to work with social media and embrace these positives you're talking about instead of feeling like you're fighting it all the time?
I've used social media just as a reading tool, like, you know, creating little fake Twitter pages for characters and To Kill a Mockingbird or something so students can, you know, live tweet from the trial and put themselves in the characters' positions. Obviously, that's not the extent to which students should relate to characters in a literary text, but it's a good sort of entry activity for students who are maybe a little hesitant to dive in because they're intimidated by the language. You can get students to respond to the characters first, and you can get them to sort of zero in on the themes and the larger ideas and how language is used and how it's structured and perspective and all these academic literary elements. But yeah, social networking, I've used it in the reading context, but not really for writing. And I don't think that personal writing is the be-all and end-all. I think students should learn all kinds of writing, and being able to talk about your feelings obviously doesn't necessarily help you when you have to write an editorial or analyze a literary text or do a research paper or anything like that. But, personal narrative writing is under assault to some degree in curricula around the country. You will hear school administrators, I'm not talking about my own, but you will hear school administrators say things along the lines of, you know, it's not as important, the student's learning how to defend a position and argue a point, because, you know, these are the skills that, students are told that are more important, that are more valuable in our society. But I think personal narrative writing is very important. I mean, education isn't just about getting you prepared for, a future career. It may be preparing you to be a better citizen and be more comfortable in your own skin and live well in the world, and having that outlet for self-expression may be very key to that.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
That was Andrew Simmons, a writer and teacher in California.
Coming up next, a new report says running for office is way, way down on the list of career goals for young people. We'll find out why after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.